Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm Craig Box.
And I'm Adam Glick.
Let's start with Adam's game of the week.
I was looking for something interesting this weekend and just couldn't believe I looked through the top lists and every game seems to be obviously a slight overstatement, but like a Clash of Clans, you know, clone, a Bejeweled clone or a slot machine clone.
And this is an interesting conversation. Would you like to pay $10 to continue it? 9, 8, 7. The pressure is on, my friend. 6.
Can I buy coins? Is there a loot box for me?
Perhaps. We're going to give you a few coins to make you feel like you've achieved something.
I was looking for something different, and I stumbled across a game I'd heard about before, came out a few years ago, called A Normal Lost Phone, which basically the game is narrative-driven, and it creates a fake kind of phone experience in the app. And you basically have found someone's lost phone and you're trying to discover who they are, what's going on in their life.
Okay.
And it was they do some clever mechanics as to, you know, how do they keep things hidden? You know, how do you find things at certain points? How do you make sure you're reading kind of the story in order? It was clever. I enjoyed it. It was fun to go through.
Brilliant.
How about you, Craig? What have you done last week? Have you gotten some sunshine?
There was an occasional sunshine here. There's also occasional snow, which is just the brilliance of UK weather overall. Did get a chance to get out last week and see New Zealand rock royalty Neil Finn and his son Liam. In fact, the whole Finn family performing in East London, quite the other side of town from me and under normal circumstances.
Would people know those people from other bands by chance?
Yes. So Neil Finn's had a very storied career. Our American audience will probably remember a song called Don't Dream It's Over, which was number 2 by Crowded House in 1985. And unfortunately, didn't make it to number 1 in the US. They were solely a number 2 one-hit wonder over there, but they had a fantastic worldwide career, especially in my native New Zealand, where the Finns are from. And Fleetwood Mac fans will have opinions on the replacement of Lindsey Buckingham with Neil Finn in the band this year, but apparently everyone's kind of warmed to him. He's filling in that role very well. But he found a break from Fleetwood Mac tour to continue touring an album that him and his son Liam, who's also a fantastic musician, put together, and we got to see that show last week. It was a very intimate show in a very old theatre in Hackney, and for someone who can sell out stadiums, it's performs in those kind of bands, it's always nice for the little shows for the fans, for these little obscure records that he puts out every now and then.
Nice. Shall we get to the news?
Core DNS has graduated as the 4th top-level project in the Cloud Native Computing Foundation, joining Kubernetes, Prometheus, and Envoy. Core DNS is a fast, flexible, modern DNS server written in Go, and the recommended DNS service for Kubernetes as of 1.13. Core DNS was originally written by Meek Geben, then an SRE on GKE here in London, and now has 16 active maintainers and over 100 contributors.
Intel has released Nauta, an open-source distributed deep learning platform for Kubernetes. Nauta provides a multi-user distributed computing environment for running deep learning model training experiments on Intel-based systems. Results can be viewed and monitored using the command line, web UI, or tensor board. Intel describes Nauta as a production-ready version of Google's Kubeflow, in which Intel is the third largest code contributor. If you want to know more about Kubeflow, we discussed it with David Aronchik back in show number 2.
Ian Lewis, a developer advocate at Google Cloud, has published the 4th and final part in a series of blog posts on container runtimes. Over the past months, Ian has focused on low and high-level container runtimes, and in the final post, he wraps up by looking at the Container Runtime Interface, or CRI, and how Kubernetes interacts with CRI-compliant runtimes. If you're looking to understand how the pieces fit together with running containers in a Kubernetes cluster, this is a great series to read.
Google Cloud has started a blog series on Istio to provide a practical guide where they cover all kinds of user perspectives, from developers and cluster operators to security administrators and SREs. Through real use cases, they'll shed the light on the what and the how of using the Istio service mesh. The first post in the series is by Megan O'Keefe and defines what Istio is and some of the challenges Istio can solve. If you want to know more about Istio, check out our interview with Dan Cirilli and Jasmine Yaksik in episode 15.
OVH, a French cloud company and VPS provider, launched their managed Kubernetes service to beta in November. They've posted about how that service operates. They use Kubernetes to manage the master components for the other Kubernetes clusters, which they call Kubeinception. Similar approaches have been discussed by Giant Swarm and SAP, and we have links to all of them in the show notes.
The GKE plugin for Jenkins is now generally available. This lets you set up a GKE cluster as a Jenkins publisher to easily deploy code to GKE clusters.
UC Newmalin from Container has been playing with GitHub Actions, GitHub's new workflow tool currently in private beta. UC has integrated Container's Mortar deployment tool to trigger deployments when pushes are made, and helps explain how you can set up this workflow, or one like it, yourself.
In another sign that the market is hot for those with Kubernetes skills, an article was published this week showing what the benefits are of working in the cloud-native world. The article says that there are almost 17,000 open jobs on LinkedIn in the US alone, and that salaries vary from between $75,000 to over $215,000 a year, with the average being over $144,000 a year. Just another proof point that Kubernetes skills are in high demand and the need for good engineers is growing.
And that's the news. Henning Jacobs is the head of developer productivity at Zalando and responsible for providing a cloud-native application runtime to over 1,100 developers. Last week, Henning published a blog post and a GitHub repository with a list of Kubernetes failure stories, postmortems, and other outage documentation, and he's also contributed to this with his own stories from Zalando. Welcome to the show, Henning.
Yeah, welcome. Nice to be here. Great for the invitation.
Happy to extend it. Just to give people a sense of who Zalando is, can you tell us what is Zalando and what do they do?
Yeah, Zalando is Europe's biggest e-commerce fashion site. So we basically sell fashion, shoes, etc. online in 17 European countries.
Is it an online-only operation or do you have a physical presence?
Yeah, we have some outlet stores, but only 4 to 5 in Germany. And so it's online.
How long have you been at Zalando?
That's a hard question. So I started 2010 at Zalando and partly was tasked as a system operator at that time and then moved between teams. So now, since a year and a bit, I'm responsible for the developer infrastructure, but was barely an infrastructure for a longer time and switched roles back and forth.
And being in e-commerce, I assume that you have fairly spiky workloads depending on sales, time of year, etc.
Yeah, it depends a little bit. So we have a different business model. One is more like a shopping club, which is really campaigns and spiky workloads or spiky loads. Mm-hmm. But the regular fashion store online has quite regular spikes over the week. So this is kind of pretty regular over weeks.
A little more predictable, the load.
Yeah, it's predictable. At one part of the business. Not everyone is predictable, but
how did Kubernetes find its way into Zalando?
We actually migrated to the cloud 2015, and then later on we discovered that just running EC2 with Docker on it is not really scalable and future proof. So in 2016 we looked into Kubernetes and then started slowly ramping this up. And since last year we barely considered this general available and now try to achieve 100% overall Kubernetes adoption.
When you say 100%, you mean that 100% of your operations are running in Kubernetes and not in VMs anymore?
Yeah, of course, this is not the case yet, but until end of next year or this year, it's now 2019 already, and we try to ramp this up. I mean, 100% is always kind of hard to achieve, but for all applications which ran in the cloud on EC2, to be on Kubernetes. We still have some, I call them vintage data centers, which are not really to be considered much. There are only a few deployments every week, but these are a different story.
How has Kubernetes improved the developer experience at Zalando?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because I think this is the main plus for Kubernetes, is that actually we want to improve the developer experience overall, and Kubernetes gives us the tooling to make it extensible. So, for example, integrate our Zalando IAMIT system as custom resource definitions, integrate Postgres with our Postgres operator. So we now have kind of a unified view on things via the Kubernetes API and CI/CD. And of course, it's much faster to deploy containers and start them up than to deploy VMs or start up EC2 instances.
And has it all been smooth sailing?
Of course not. I wouldn't share this failure stories topic if it would be smooth sailing. So I think there are technical, organizational, there are a lot of challenges, like every kind of big project. But yeah, Kubernetes is in a lot of forms not really mature yet. And yeah, of course, you have to deal with it and also with the release velocity of Kubernetes. So yeah, we can, dive into the failures right away. But I guess this is no secret that you shouldn't take this lightly to go to Kubernetes and cloud native if you don't have so much experience with that yet.
So your first experience with sharing failure stories was in a talk at, was it DevOpsCon in Munich last year?
Yeah, that was actually the most recent talk, but actually I started with a small meetup talk in Düsseldorf which is also linked on my blog post. It's badly similar, and then I evolved it over time and will also like include more failure stories which come up. So I think this will be a never-ending talk series.
What made you decide to share the stories of failures in your Kubernetes environment?
I think this is totally driven by my own and or our motivation to learn from other people's experiences and failures. And I think one good way is giving back and actually showing people that this is not such a big deal to share these failures. And
right.
If we talk more about it, I think it also takes maybe away some fears of others to talk also about these topics.
Was it hard to get sign off from your management to be so public and going out and talking about incidences of failure?
Yeah, this is a nice part about Zalando. So it's kind of, it's generally, I mean, now I'm responsible for the whole developer infrastructure, including Kubernetes. And I think I can make a lot of calls myself and, of course, making sure that we don't share sensitive and like business topics. But I think it's in our interest as a company to really engage with the community, learn from each other. Like we have a lot of open source project already out there. So, and I think this is part of how we want to engage and be a good citizen in the open source community. So there was no extra approval or something.
Your PR people didn't want to get involved?
Yeah, I guess we wouldn't put it as a big press release out there, like how Zalando failed. But maybe when I looked for failure stories, it's often how things are framed is this is kind of how we migrated. This is the success stories. And then on the way, the challenges are explained. And I think I wanted to turn it a little bit around to make it more open to learn about the failures. But I think a lot of these failures and challenges are always hidden in these success stories. So if you would do a press release and you put probably do it in the reverse and how like in the end, this was a success and these are where the challenges we are overcoming.
I always think of stories where things have failed as being great examples that people can learn from. I joke about the only bridge that people know about where I live is the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. And they only know about that because of its catastrophic failure that happened. It's now every engineering textbook. You've decided to aggregate failure stories.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to aggregate not only what happens in your organization, but other failure stories as well and put them together?
What I forgot to mention, which is also in my blog post, is of course, I didn't come up with this great idea to now do a big failure series. Actually, others were before me, right? And others were adopting also Kubernetes earlier than we did at Zalando. So I think this Nordstrom talk on KubeCon, which I listened to, was very impressive for me. And I said, okay, this is kind of, it was the best talk at this KubeCon. I think it was 2017. I don't remember actually, but so this had a impression on me to like say, why don't we have more of these talks where we really go through these stories where these are both entertaining, engaging, and a lot to learn from. So this is, I think, as you can already see from the titles, I just stole somehow this title and made it a million ways to crash your cluster.
What makes it relevant to talk about the failures in the cases of Kubernetes versus things that have happened in the past?
Yeah, I guess if you look at traditional environments, like in the data centers or similar, then it's always so diverse how this is set up and so dependent on how your vendor operates the data center, etc. So, of course, there is also a lot of failure stories and postmortems to learn from. But if I think about stuff going on in our data center, if there is a core router failing or similar, this would not be something where the community can learn from because it highly depends on the network setup and vendors and service providers, etc., dealing with this in the data center, for example. Of course, the cloud, like without Kubernetes, is also something to learn from. And I think a nice example is that immediately after I launched this Kubernetes failure stories repo, there was already a serverless failure stories repository. So I think there are a lot of more topics where we can also do the similar topic. But of course, in my example, Kubernetes is what we operate and offer. And Kubernetes has a great attribute that it's now like so common and ubiquitous that it's even greater to learn from each other. And so it's even more important that we share our failure stories because we are so many users, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and really glad that you do. Everyone should take a read through some of these because there's some great lessons in it. You've been collecting these stories, and I'm wondering, since your work with Zalando goes back before your usage of Kubernetes, were you doing this before Kubernetes, or is this something that started recently as you've been in the Kubernetes community?
No, I must confess, I started recently. So I would have liked to say that I'm great from learning from failures and we always did postmortem since 2010. But I think we are also growing up as a company, and also the whole topic of operations, reliability, SRE, 24/7 on call, dealing incident response, postmortems and so on. This is also evolving over time. Of course, this was also already there before Kubernetes. But yes, I myself was only kind of course, involved with postmortems inside the company, but didn't really consider sharing this. And I think this is also kind of this cycle that if we engage with this open source community, with the components we have on GitHub for Kubernetes, that this is actually a natural trend that you also think about what else to share and learn from, because it's not only about code, it's also about how to deal with the code and components, how they work together and how to actually set this up.
This is an area where people with experience in running services have a lot more insight, especially in how the parts work together, than perhaps even the people who built the individual components. So given that we're here today with a world expert in the failure states of Kubernetes, let's talk about a few of the specific areas that are often cited in these postmortems as well as your own. Mm-hmm. Let's start off by talking about etcd.
Yeah, etcd. I don't want to go too deep into etcd. I think one topic which came up in different places is, and also one failure we had, for example, which I also shared in the talk, is the connection from API server to etcd and the different ways how to do it, where to operate etcd, right? So if it's on the master node, if it's separate outside of Kubernetes, if we daily run it on our own, of course, like manage Kubernetes on GKE, we wouldn't even see this component. And I think this is not as straightforward as one might think. And for example, in our case, this was really the connection from API server to etcd and discovering that the client is not really resilient to, for example, small network failures. And one packet loss in one direction can actually lead to this hanging connections and never recovering. And this is a little bit disappointing from our experience, of course, because we're talking about cloud native and then you discover like internal components not really living up to the principles of cloud native and being resilient to the small network failures. But I don't want to go into etcd itself because I don't have all the expert knowledge there. I guess how components interact. I mean, this is distributed systems. This is the fun part, running one etcd node.
Are there other components in the Kubernetes environment where the resilience isn't there?
A lot of the failure stories I shared also linked then to some GitHub issues, and some are also already resolved. I think another topic which is now resolved was kind of kubelet connection to the Kubernetes API server. I'm not 100% of it sure if it's really solved, but there was also kind of missing resilience against, for example, the change of IPs of the API server endpoint and reconnecting. So all these hanging connections or things which are not recovering automatically, these are of course like kind of lead to some frustration and also potentially incidents. And I guess there are a ton of more of these cases which I don't know of, and we will find only by looking into failure stories.
What are the some of the examples from cloud vendor integration?
Yes, this is a long story. There was on the Hacker News thread also a comment that like most of the failure stories are related to AWS. And my answer was, of course, this is a really biased sample because you have to operate this on your own on AWS and or also on other cloud vendors. So, and this, of course, leads to maybe more potential problems to do things wrong. But in this case, yes, for example, persistent volumes was always a big pain point. I think it's now better, but this was for a long time and maybe still is in some corner cases a huge pain point for us on AWS. So lately, persistent volumes not really being attached to the node, etc. Of course, there are also a lot of other topics, and one big topic, which is, I think, also not really solved on Google, I cannot say for Azure, is, for example, IAM integration, which is maybe not core Kubernetes, but it's something where, for example, in an AWS world, IP tables is redirected to a proxy, and there are race conditions, which lead to kind of problems. So to work around these, yeah, persistent volumes, AWS, IAM integration. Then there are, of course, the usual topics like rate limiting from cloud vendors. So if the core components or control loop do too many API calls to the cloud vendor, then you're badly DDoSing yourself And this is a huge pain which you cannot recover yourself from.
What about Docker or the container runtime?
Luckily, Docker is now not a big topic for us anymore, but I think this was for a long time, and I guess a lot of people will agree, and there are some really horrible cases where Docker failed us. So if the Docker daemon is hanging, then you really don't know what to do. So Kubernetes cannot talk with the Docker daemon. You cannot really do anything, but the workloads are still running, but you cannot really gracefully move them away or do anything, because also the Docker daemon restart was scarcely restarting the containers in the past. So this is one example. There are also like a lot of race conditions or pipe wait states of processes in the Docker daemon, which also led to investigations on the Docker node or the node and not really able to do anything. And I mean, no secret, this is mentioned in a lot of talks, right? Even Google has on GKE this infamous bash script, which hacks if Docker daemon is still responsive, and I think every 10 seconds, and then kills the Docker daemon. So yeah, even cloud providers need to find workarounds to make some things component.
Yeah, I think collectively we've come to the conclusion that having a daemon in that space isn't the right thing, which has led obviously to Docker decoupling some of this into Containerd, and glad to hear that those problems sound like they're predominantly on the way out.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. I'm now here the first people really running Containerd in production. So we don't do that yet, and looking forward to alternative, more lightweight and maybe runtimes which cause less trouble. But all in all, Docker is right now no issue anymore for us. So maybe we just survived the hell and now it's kind of stable enough to not be a topic.
What about DNS?
Yeah, this was actually the trigger for this blog post. So we had an incident the beginning of this month regarding DNS, so cluster DNS. And this is not totally, I mean, most of these failure stories are not completely a fault of kind of the Kubernetes core components or anything, but how they play together and how to size them for your workloads. And DNS is one of these things. If DNS is down in your cluster, then your workloads have a hard time to do anything, right? And I think this is also the other nice blog post about first 90 days with EKS also mentions how to tune kubeDNS and making sure that it like grows with your capacity or your workloads running on the cluster. And in this case, how it failed us was really something where we had a huge spike of DNS requests from a Node.js app, and this spike was very sudden. So even Prometheus metrics, which are scraping every 15 seconds, didn't really see this memory bump. So it was not kind of a low, slow growing memory curve or anything. And this badly led to core DNS, which we are running in production, kind of being killed with out of memory. And because this requests are also constantly trying to do the DNS again, we had to bump this a lot to 2 gigabytes of memory just to kind of at least recover this first burst of DNS request. And now we are really looking into this node local DNS mask plus core DNS and hopefully also share more with the community. So we have an internal narrative, how we set this up, how to configure caching. I mean, there are a lot of knobs you have to tune and know about, right? There's this N.5 problem. There is whether you want to cache NX domain or not, whether you run core DNS as caching or DNS mask, etc., etc. So a lot of options, and barely nobody really tells you how to evaluate these different options and what is the right setup for your case.
A common failure case that people had described to me in the past was basically running out of CPU on a node and then finding that some of the system components were killed as opposed to user workloads. We have now requests and limits and so on, which we can apply to these workloads. And if you happen to have your kube proxy killed, for example, that might cause you a bit of a bad time. But what problems have you seen around the quotas and scheduling of workloads?
I think this is a whole like a different can of worms, this Kubernetes resources, because I think one big chunk is kind of how like also your end users or developers or Kubernetes users know about these knobs. So this is one thing where you kind of have some education needs, but also for the cluster operators, as you already mentioned, right? System components you want to have with higher priority, with like kind of guaranteed quality of service, etc. You would probably want to have allocatable reserve resources per node. So also in this case, you have to know about all these different knobs and know about what components actually run per node, how to kind of give them the right resources. So this is all from cluster operator side. And there is no kind of recipe to do it end to end for whatever setup. So that's why we also actually shared, for example, also our whole cluster configuration on GitHub. So you can at least compare whatever you want to do in your company with what we configured. So this is a cluster operator side. I think this is really about tuning the resources. Then there is this whole user side to resources. So you have to know what is the impact of limits, and CPU throttling is a big topic because it's not only throttling you if you hit the limit, but also already before, which is kind of a known kernel bug. But actually, when I say known, it's not known in the Kubernetes community. So everybody who has actually low latency workloads will hit this one day or another. And then the first step is always removing limits from the pod or container resources. But as we learned on one of the last KubeCons, one option is really disabling CFS quota on the kubelet level. And that's actually what we did in all clusters. And this works for us. I wouldn't say to do this for all clusters out there, because in our case, we have this kind of scope per cluster and we don't really have multi-tenancy per cluster, or different teams who are working on one cluster, they are still in one area and can kind of align. So yeah, I mean, there are probably a lot of more like paths to go down now, right? We can talk about memory and out of memory and whether you want to have overcommit or not, and what guidance you give to your users or not. We decided to not do overcommit for memory. So we say request and limits to prevent this OM kill by the kernel, like the also looking in this Facebook OMD blog post, right? You want to prevent this horror scenario that even the cluster operator cannot do anything anymore on the node because it's kind of getting out of control. So I think this is a mixture of knowledge for your users and educating them, doing the right thing as a cluster operator, but also finding a strategy how this whole setup works in your organization and how much control the user has and cluster operator, and how this all fits together, how much multi-tenancy or not you want to allow. So this is barely something probably we can talk about 3 hours and we will still find topics which are unclear or questions to answer.
What do you think is the operational failure story that you personally learned the most from?
I think like always the most interesting learnings are actually not so much about the deep technical topics, right? For example, taking the DNS example, it's actually not so interesting to have to find the right setup. Of course, it's technically interesting, but actually the organizational learnings are often much more interesting. So, okay, how does incident response work? Was the escalation chain working? Are we really setting the right priorities in what we do? So overall, I would say in the individual failures, the technical details, those are kind of just things you learn once from. But the overarching topics are organizational priorities, incident response, processes, right mindset, etc. So that's why I would say like each individual incident, there was none which totally was outstanding. There were some of them which were in the beginnings, which I also showed in the talk, where we badly made mistakes in relying too much on certain like behaviors. For example, our ingress controller relied on the API server to be available. And this is, of course, something, you have to learn once and then hopefully not repeat the same mistake again.
Along those lines, my colleague John Wilkes, who gave a lot of talks about Omega, a project he was one of the tech leads on, and then leading into Kubernetes as it was open sourced, he said that a lot of the reason that he talked about this was to ensure that people only made new mistakes.
Yeah.
He says he doesn't mind people making mistakes, but they shouldn't be making the same ones over again.
Yeah.
Do you feel that the Kubernetes community is at the point where they're only making new mistakes?
Not yet, I guess. I mean, like when I collected this postmortems, I was actually shocked that I didn't find so many more. And so until now, I only got 2 PRs for the GitHub repo. So I think considering how many companies I know run Kubernetes in production, I would like to hear a lot more. And of course, we also as Zalando have to do a better job in sharing with the community. So I guess without that, we cannot really say that we learn enough from our mistakes. And just taking this CFS quota example, there were, I think, 3 or 4 companies who gathered at this KubeCon Europe around the CPU throttling topic. And yes, we found kind of the solution and talked about it. But this is not really persisted right now. Of course, this is also like kind of partly my responsibility to like take the next steps. But I think these smaller discussions are really valuable. But how do they really reach the broader audience and the broader community? And I think there are so many companies or people joining the community every day. Yeah, how do you transfer this knowledge and make sure that this is kind of the important pieces? In the end, hopefully, the documentation part in Kubernetes, which I confess I didn't contribute anything yet to Kubernetes IO docs, but hopefully there will
be... It's still early.
Yes, hopefully there will be a production guidelines or like how to run in production and some more than we have right now in the docs.
We can form sig.production.
Yeah, I guess we don't lack SIGs, I must say. So I think there are enough special interest group. And I try to engage with some, but I also have limited time. So of course, there are a lot which are interesting to our use case. So there is AWS, there is also cluster ops and cluster lifecycle, etc. But yeah, it's hard to be engaged everywhere. And then let's think about all the other people who are just joining and going to the docs and didn't even find the community repo with all the SIG links.
Thank you so much, Henning. This is fascinating. And I encourage everybody to take a look at the blog post and the recordings of the presentations that you have done. I think people learn a lot from that.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to find Henning on Twitter, you can find him at @try_accept, that with an E and a second underscore.
There's one background to it. My name is already taken and look it up. My first name, last name, then you will find it's not me, but I came late to Twitter.
So late the @try_accept with no underscore at the end was also taken?
I didn't try, but it has to have consistency, right?
A balanced number of underscores.
Yeah.
Thank you, as always, for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, we really appreciate it if you help us spread the word and tell some friends. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at @KubernetesPod, or you can reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out our website at KubernetesPodcast.com, where you can find the show notes as well as transcripts for every one of the episodes. Until next time, take care.
See you next week.